Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking the future of work with Derek Thompson.
Yeah, so we are undoubtedly going to have a wide-ranging conversation with our guest today, Derek Thompson. We are big fans of his work. It hardly seems necessary to introduce him, but he is a senior editor over at The Atlantic. I think he's been there for around 15 years now and has since been recognized for his work, his narratives on topic like the future of work and the science of popularity. His notable book, Hitmakers, that was a bestseller that delves into the secret histories of pop culture hits and the dynamics of what makes something popular. But Derek also hosts the podcast Plain English, which I rarely miss an episode of personally, where he offers weekly insights into the latest news, things he's most interested in, as well as important issues that our society faces today, like the changing views of what work should and shouldn't be. So that's what we'll be talking about today. Maybe we'll touch on the Vibe session. Plenty more to cover today with you, Derek. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you, guys.
Of course. Yeah. Okay. First question we ask anybody who comes on the show, Derek, is what do they like to splurge on? Because Matt and I, we drink craft beer. Sometimes it's a little expensive and people might say, wait, but you guys are supposed to be frugal. Why are you spending so much on beer? And it's because that's our craft beer equivalent. Everybody has one, something they splurge on while they're being smart. They're saving and investing for the future. So what's yours?
Mine is wine. Ooh. There's absolutely no question that that wine is my luxury item. When my wife or anybody else asks me, what do I want for my birthday? I say, please don't get me anything that I can't finish in one night. Make it a bottle of wine. Or make it a bottle of bourbon, which I tend not to finish in one night because that would be extremely dangerous. But I suppose if you invite enough people over to your house to share in the bottle of bourbon, it's possible. But seriously, the only thing I spend money on are liquids, essentially, alcoholic liquids. I love wine. It's incredibly important to me. My dad, my late dad who passed away a few years ago, was a wine critic for the Washington Post. Oh. That was his side job. To being a lawyer in Washington, D.C. I got introduced to wine when I was a really young kid. And I wish I could tell you that I liked all different kinds of wine and, could totally drink the cheap stuff and enjoy it. I have an incredibly annoying palate, as they say. I think even describing, saying the word palate is probably annoying itself. I really like fancy wine. And I love spending money on it. And, my wife and I, this is maybe a longer answer than you were prepared for, because wine is such an important indulgence for me.
Go on. I love it.
My wife and I have a saying in our household that, you know, sometimes it'll be like a Tuesday or a Wednesday. Nothing in particular will be important happening. There's no birthday, no anniversary. But we'll just feel like really great. It will have had like maybe just like a great day or just be in a particularly good mood. And we'll really want to open up a bottle of really nice wine. And we used to sometimes think, oh, you know, like opening up like, you know, a $50, $60, $70 bottle of wine on a Tuesday makes no sense because then you have to finish the whole thing. That's like so much money to spend on, you know, for nothing. But now we have a saying in our household, which is drink the wine. Whenever we feel excited and giddy about the world, even if it's a Tuesday or Wednesday of no import, we say, what the heck, drink the wine. Yeah, wine's incredibly important to me, and I love spending too much money on it.
I love it.
Okay, two follow-up questions on that. If I came over to your house and I brought over a bottle of Kirkland's signature wine,
yeah.
How would you feel about that? Would you automatically turn me away? And two, is it possible to get good wine in the $20 bottle range?
Number two, I'll answer them in the opposite order that you asked them. Absolutely, it's possible to get great bottles of wine in the $20 range. I think it's easier for whites. I think it's easier for, you know, whites like Chenin Blanc that aren't like, you know, Chardonnay, things that go up to the moon in terms of price because they tend to be grown really highly out in Napa and Sonoma. But absolutely, it's easy to get good, often great $20 bottles of wine. You just have to work in varietals that aren't you know, the biggies. You're probably not going to get a fantastic $20 cab from California. But if you're talking about something like Grenache, or you're talking about maybe a Spanish wine, Italian wine, absolutely. You can get fantastic stuff in the $20 range.
All right.
And then first, what would happen if you brought over Kirkland Select or something? Well, look, I remember I once with my grandmother, this will give you a sense of how much I drink and how much my family drinks. We once did a vodka test. My grandmother loves vodka. She's 96 years old. And we did a vodka test with, she had some Belvedere and some Grey Goose and some Kirkland Select and some regular Kirkland. Yeah. And we tried all the various vodkas, and she liked Kirkland Select the best. That was for vodka. As for wine, I think I would smile politely and say thank you if I thought that maybe you didn't realize what you had bought. But if I knew you better, I'd think you're probably playing a prank on me, and I would laugh and ask you to chug the whole thing before you stepped into my house.
Gotcha. Well,
what's funny is, like, you mentioned the Kirkland Sig vodka, and the rumor is that
it's Grey Goose, right?
Is the maker of the French vodka.
Mm-hmm.
But so yeah, good to know that Joel can't bring over a bottle of Josh over to Derek's house. Derek, your writing, it tends to operate in a bunch of different topics, like across a broad spectrum, but like it also kind of feels like there is a common thread in all of your work. Like when I think about your writing, it seems like we live in a disorderly, kind of chaotic world, and I feel like a lot of your writing, it tries to bring some sort of order to the world that we live in. Like, I guess what I'm asking is, do you have like a mission statement behind your writing, or are you more or less just sort of following your curiosities?
I'm absolutely guided by my curiosity, and if you can see a thread that connects my work, that makes one of us. I'm not entirely sure that I operate within anything like the strictures of a beat. I'm very, very, very lucky in both my writing life at The Atlantic and my podcasting life at The Ringer that I can pretty much write whatever I want. And I do write just about whatever I want. Working on an article right now for The Atlantic about the history of work, working on a podcast right now about an NYU psychologist's research into how social media warps our brains and our sense of reality. I'm interested in doing future podcasts right now on the future of cancer research and health fads. I'm sort of interested in the world, and I like the concept of sense-making, as you put it. I like the idea that my job is to investigate, you know, mysteries in the world, and that's pretty much what I see my job as being, to find important mysteries that affect a lot of people in the world, to do my best to make sense of them.
I remember hearing you talk about getting the job offer at The Atlantic and the kind of convoluted way that went down, and you ended up getting, at least to start out with, I know you've branched out since then, but you ended up getting the economics beat. Mm-hmm. That was like what you most didn't want to write about. Why was that?
Well, I was given, right, so I'm 22 years old or 23 years old at The Atlantic, and I'm basically an intern at the time, and they come up to me in the eighth floor, which is where the sort of communications interns sat, and they said, hey, do you want to write for theatlantic.com for the economics desk? And my first answer was absolutely not. I don't know anything about economics. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and when we got the Washington Post every single week, the only section of that newspaper that I would throw in the trash was the business section. I was interested in everything in the world except for business and economics. And so I told them, no, like, please don't make me do this. I'll embarrass you, and I won't have a good time doing it. And they were great about it. They said, look, we think you can do it. And the truth is, if you're bad at this, we'll just fire you back to your old job. So the opportunity cost of taking this position is absolutely zero. So I gave it a shot and ended up realizing, you know, to my own surprise, that economics was for me a really useful lens through which to see the world. You know, I write about macroeconomics quite a bit and podcast about macroeconomics quite a bit. I'd say that my interests are more wide-ranging than simply economic. But there's ways in which economics, I think, has provided a useful lens because it, at least in the way that I looked at it, economics was the study of how people live and how the incentives of their life influence their life. And when you think about economics from a really abstract level like that, well, it opens up a lot of fields of interest that have nothing to do with specific businesses.
Yeah, I think I saw that you are like a triple major at Northwestern, and economics wasn't one of them. So
yeah, I should say the triple major thing is a little bit BS. So I would say.
Oh, is it okay?
Yeah, I got a.
It's quadruple, Matt.
Speaking of BS, I got a. Yeah. First off, it's a quintuple major. How dare you? So I went to the journalism school, the Medill School of Journalism, and they encourage everybody, just about everybody, to get a double major. So I double majored in political science. I should hasten to say I don't think political science is a very useful major. I've joked before that. Practically all the classes that I took seemed to be about why World War I happened, and the answer to all those classes is we don't know. So I didn't get a whole lot out of my political science major, and toward the end of my 4 years at Northwestern, which I overall loved, I thought that I might want to be a lawyer, and so I picked up legal studies as a third major. And it was one of these majors where you can take a few seminars and write a thesis, and then double count a lot of other classes, then get credit for a third major. This is probably not the disquisition you wanted on my triple major. But basically, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer because I thought that being a lawyer meant acting like Lieutenant Danny Caffey in A Few Good Men, as played by Tom Cruise.
That's exactly what it's like.
Right. A lawyer's job is just to scream at Jack Nicholson and then get clapped at. And it turned out very quickly that that was not what a lawyer's job was. And so I decided to sort of abandon the gotcha. Lawyer path and stuck with journalism.
Well, again, it makes sense, you growing up there in D.C. But yeah, it sounds like, do you ever play, man, this is such a tangent, but you ever play Ticket to Ride board game?
Oh, hell yeah. I love Ticket to Ride.
Okay, so Derek, this is you getting that legal studies degree, was you drawing other routes and realizing that all you had to do is build one more train segment, and all of a sudden you have like a coast-to-coast kind of...
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have played Ticket to Ride, the European version,
oh, yeah.
But all you really have to do is just build through like sort of modern Siberia, Poland. Like you have to dominate in the Northeast. Right, the Northeast essentially was my journalism. I realized that's where I really needed to extend my train line. And all those tiny little rails in the center of, Western Europe, where it's big cities, it's attractive, but you realize you're not getting a lot of points from them. Yeah. That was the legal studies major.
Yeah, stay away from London, no matter what. Okay, let's talk about money finally, and not board games. But like, what is your take on where the economy stands right now? Because it seems like a lot might depend on your stage of life. Because if you purchased a car, if you purchased a home, say 5 years ago, you're thinking, the economy's it's great. Everything's firing on all cylinders.
I got lots of equity and a low interest rate.
But
right?
If you missed out, mm-hmm. like that period of time was such like a golden window for folks to enter into adulthood. So I'm curious of your overall thoughts on sort of, I guess, the vibe session and how folks are feeling about the economy.
Yeah, let me try to do a really quick summary on how I see the economy right now. And we can just do bad news first and good news second. So bad news, inflation is coming down, but it's still positive. And inflation describes the rate of change in prices. So when the rate of change in prices goes from a really high number to a less high number, that means that prices are still getting higher. And prices still are really very much above where they were 4 years ago in things like groceries. Also, interest rates are elevated. And so if you are a middle-class person buying a lot of groceries, and especially if you are looking to buy a new car, lease a new car, buy a new house, well, then the economy is really tough for you right now because lots of prices in the economy are high. Your wage might not have grown very much. I'll talk a little bit more about the stratification of wage growth by inflation in just a second. But if you're trying to buy a house, you're trying to buy a big ticket item like a house or a car, interest rates are high enough that that's a really, really expensive thing. And so you're going to kind of feel locked out of that part of the economy because of higher interest rates. Now, here's the good thing. wages overall are growing faster than inflation, and they have been for just about a year. They're growing fastest at the bottom, and they're growing slowest toward the top. So this is a pretty good economy if you are a lower income worker who does not necessarily need to find a new apartment, find a new home. Your wages have been growing. You've been able to trade up for a lot of, you know, trade up maybe from a low paying service sector job to a higher paying service sector job. And if you don't have to find a new apartment, you can stay in the apartment that you have, and you haven't had to suffer the same kind of rent inflation. We've seen wage growth be positive compared to inflation. Unemployment is unbelievably low. Inequality is falling because low-wage workers are getting raises faster than high-wage workers, and productivity is growing. Plus, you have the strong equity growth over the last few years if you do own. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of like, there's, you know, obviously the economy is not just one thing. It's 330 million people's experience of an environment and of different prices in different states and different places. If you own, if you are a high-ish income worker, this is a pretty good economy for you. But if you're trying to break into the housing market and you're still relying and you're, you know, sort of not making as much money as you want to, and you're suffering from grocery inflation, it's a much harder economy. So very good in some ways, not as good in others.
You said we're going to start with bad news, and then pretty quickly we got into good news, and you had a litany of good news. And it feels like the difference between perception and reality, at least from where I'm sitting, have never been farther apart. And the doomeristic tendencies, right? Like they are just significant right now. There was some new recent study in Nature magazine saying like that the most doomeristic headlines with the pessimistic outlook got more clicks. There's like this incentive too, I think, from the media to talk about what's bad sometimes, even when things are overwhelmingly good. And I think maybe that colors how we perceive things, and maybe how we even like think about our own lives. So I don't know. Do you think that's true? And how do you square the actual reality on the ground, the largely positive economic numbers, with how people are feeling about things?
It's a great question, and it's one that I've wrestled with quite a bit. I don't think there's any value to, or let me put it differently, I think there is limited value to telling people who are having a negative experience of the economy that they're wrong. People's experience is their life. And if they're experiencing hardship, then there's no point in saying, well, you're not actually experiencing hardship because look at these productivity numbers. You're not actually experiencing hardship because look at this unemployment rate. Hardship is hardship. That said, I do think that a lot of the general pessimism of the economy is what my friend Kyla Scanlon calls a vibe session rather than something that is like a recession. Wall Street Journal recently had a study where they asked people in swing states to estimate the, or excuse me, to express the their sentiment of the quality of the economy where they lived in their state and the quality of the national economy. In every single state, their assessment of the economy was positive. And in every single state, their assessment of the national economy was negative. Hmm. And this feeds into a phenomenon that I have described in a previous essay as everything's terrible, but I'm fine. That is, there seems to be some psychology at work whereby our attitude or sentiment gets more negative the more national or universal we're asked to reflect on the world.
It's kind of like how we hate Congress, but we love our own congressperson.
Absolutely. Or we think America's school system is going to hell in a handbasket, but how's your own school? Oh, we quite love it for, you know, young Tommy. I think there's a lot of ways in which our assessment of our own lives tends to be more positive because of resilience and because of experience. And our assessment of the world is mediated by the news media. And as you pointed out, there's some NYU research that suggests that the news media has a negativity bias, in part, by the way, because news audiences have a negativity bias. And so as news media is clamoring to get attention, they realize that the cliche is true. If it bleeds, it leads. Or more precisely, I suppose, I don't know how to make this rhyme, but if it bleeds, she will click. Hmm. People tend to, when they see a five-alarm fire, feel their attention gravitate toward it. And in a way, I don't want to, you know, sort of open up too many tabs here, but in a way, I think that this goes to the fact that I think we are, or our attention is, dis-evolved for the world we live in. I think that we're probably evolved to have our attention gravitate to bad news. After all, if you're a hunter-gatherer on the savannah and you see a bunch of things that look fine and then one thing that looks like it's really not fine, right? Like maybe the head of a panther or a tiger that's about to kill you. Okay, we should clearly pay attention to the danger in your environment. And I think in the same way, readers on the internet are attuned to negativity for the same evolutionary impulse, and news media have cued into this negative impulse and just flooded the scene with negative news stories. And that's why, to go to the first question that you asked, I think our impression of our own lives, which is mediated only by our own experience, has to be more positive, while our impression of the country, which is mediated by actual news media, tends to be more negative.
It's interesting how it's something that is programmed into our mind. It's essentially being used against us in order to generate clicks and to generate ad revenue. But you're saying that it's being decided upon by media or legacy media, but also not to go down another tangent here, but social media. And you kind of touched on this, how it's warping our view, but the actual algorithms and what it is that we're being fed, it continues to polarize individuals, whether I think it's negative, maybe sometimes in positive ways
what
as well.
What they choose to amplify is often the angriest voices.
It's the angriest, it's the most violent, it's the things. I mean, I still get fed a bunch of like car wreck videos. and I'm like, what is it that the algorithm thinks about me that I want to see this? But it's hard for me to look away because it's difficult.
And it's also difficult, you know, not that everyone should cry for news media editors, but it is difficult for us to resist that impulse, right? Like every day, journalists across the country, around the world, obviously, wake up and think, not only what stories will I pay attention to, but also how will I present the truth, or at least my reporting, of those stories? And if every single day, journalists operating in a scarce and declining industry are fearful for their own jobs and their organization's ability to eke out an existence in an incredibly competitive ecosystem, if every day they think, well, we're going to get more clicks and more attention and more subscribers if we frame the world negatively, what you're going to get is news media that over time optimizes towards negativity. And I mean that very literally, optimizes towards negativity. Because I think that sometimes there's this misunderstanding that negativity in news is a mistake. Of course, in a way, I think that negativity bias is bad for accurate representations of reality, but in many ways, it represents a kind of optimization of engagement. And that's really, that's the issue here. In a way, the best way to represent the world clearly and honestly is to resist that kind of optimization. It's to be suboptimal in terms of getting people's attention. That's very, very difficult to ask any one news organization to do, to essentially embrace what they understand to be a suboptimal strategy.
How do you think the fracturing of the media space is impacting how we encounter news and kind of the world around us? Because the substackification of everything, the podcastification of everything is really changing where we go to get access to the things that we need to know. And in some ways, maybe we're entering into more of an echo chamber, but in other ways, it's also, I think, allowing for certain news organizations to flourish in a way that they weren't able to before. Some of the individuals or small organizations that create, you know, newsletters that are reaching hundreds of thousands of people even at this point, and are kind of taking a different tact. Like, I'm just curious what's your take on that.
Abundance of media is good. In so many ways. I think in the 1960s, 1950s, when news media was much more scarce, when Uncle Walter Cronkite reached whatever it was, 60, 70 million Americans a single night, we think of that as the golden age of media. But in many ways, it was a dark age of media. It was an age where only a handful of voices commanded our understanding of reality and truth.
Yeah.
I don't think that's optimal. I think as a news consumer, I would much prefer a world that is like the world that I live in, where I can listen to a podcast in the morning from some of the smartest, funniest commentators on sports, and then read an article by a brilliant foreign policy analyst. I mean, nothing like that riotous abundance of expertise was available before the advent of the internet, sort of created this Cambrian explosion of news outlets. But that riotous abundance, I think, has costs. And one of the costs is this, that competition is antagonistic. And by that I mean, if you have a news environment with 10,000 economic, business, and finance podcasts, and you're trying to break in to this field, the best way to break in, really, is to be antagonistic. It's to say, these big guys who've been in this business for a while, they're wrong. You know, this person that you listen to for finance and this person you listen to for economic news, they don't know what they're talking about. I'll tell you the truth, right? That's the way to break in, is to be antagonistic. But if everyone does this, what it does on net is create extraordinary, everyone loves, it's a little bit like everything's terrible, but I'm fine. Everyone loves their own news source, but believes that, quote, the media, capital T, capital M, is always lying to them. And so I do think that there's a way in which the abundance of media might lead somewhat linearly to an increase in distrust, an increase in conspiracy theorizing, and a decrease in a shared sense of reality. And I'm not entirely sure that that's good for us. And so this is why, to sort of round out the answer, I think that the evolution of news toward abundance has been very complicated in terms of netting out whether it's good or bad. On the one hand, we have more direct access to expertise than we've ever had before. And that's awesome for a dilettante-ish news consumer like me. But at the same time, I think we have to utterly give up on the idea that we're ever going to have something like shared reality in America. It's just not going to happen again.
No more wanting for what used to exist because, yeah, there's no going back.
No, but putting the genie back in that bottle.
Derek, okay, we're not only going to talk about media, we are actually going to talk about the future of work and talk about labor markets. We'll get to that and more right after the break.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. All right, we're back from the break. Still talking with Derek Thompson. We're talking about the future of work. And let's talk about work now, because that is a topic, Derek, that you focus on regularly. I'm curious. I want to kind of start this off. Maybe can you talk about the uniqueness of Americans and our country and how we view and think about work? It seems like our approach to work differs largely from so much of the rest of the world.
There's absolutely no question that Americans are the worker bees of the Western world. There's really no other country in the West that is as rich as the U.S., that works more than the U.S. It should be said that over time, Americans have worked less and less. The typical American worker in the late 19th century worked 3,000 hours a year. Today, he or she works closer to 1,700, 1,800 hours a year. And that difference, right, working 1,300 hours less a year, that's the equivalent to like 150 vacation days for the typical 9-to-5 worker. So we don't work like we did during the Second Industrial Revolution, but nonetheless, we do work a lot more than other countries. And I think you hear this experience sometimes when you talk to immigrants when they come from Europe to the U.S. They say that there really isn't the same cultural centering of work in Europe that there is in America. And I think that this is a complicated blessing. On the one hand, I think that the centrality of work in America is one reason why we tend to have so many of the largest companies in the world. Like, if you look at the biggest companies in the U.S., their average age is like 40, 50 years. It's a lot of companies that were built in 1970s, 80s, 2000s, you know, Apple and Microsoft and Meta. If you look at the biggest countries in Europe, a lot of them are from like the early 20th, late 19th century. They're really, really old. And so I think that this love of work feeds into and maybe is intertwined with this entrepreneurial spirit that I think is quite lovely. But I also think that overwork, or what I sometimes call workism, which is sort of the, you know, centering of work in one's life and treating one's career like it's a religion, also has a lot of downsides. So, you know, I think all the time about like, you know, is Americans' relationship with work good or bad for us? And like so many things that I report on, it is complicated. And there are a lot of goods with the bad.
I mean, do you think that perception towards work is changing? Like you mentioned workism, right? Like, it makes me think of younger generations' view towards work. It makes me think of the bill that Bernie Sanders proposed, the 32-hour work week, where that's going to be something that's mandated. It seems like that there is this cultural shift that's taking place. So like, yeah, it's like it's a double-edged sword. It's being wielded as something that is good, but also something that's negative.
I think there's good to it. I think that there's negative to it. And I also think to the first that you said, it's true that it's possible that attitudes toward work are changing across generations, right? When I wrote my initial essay on the phenomenon that I called workism, I was looking at a lot of data that centered on workers between the 1980s and the 2000s. And essentially what the data I was looking at found was that while, you know, throughout the world and throughout history, rich people have tended to work less, instead in the late 20th century in the US and early 21st century in the US, it was only the rich who are working more. And I asked, wait, why would rich people who can do anything with their money choose to work more? Well, maybe it's because work is what they wanted to do with their free time, that work had become so central to their life and to their identity that they were choosing to work more and creating cultures where overwork was being valued. I think that may have been true for older workers, but it might be changing among young millennials and Gen Z. I do think that, you know, fear of overwork, movements like anti-work and, you know, the anti-work subreddit, not that that's like, you know, it's just a subreddit on the one hand, but I think it reflects an evolution in thought. And I also think that Gen Z, with the rise of hybrid work, also somewhat has a different attitude toward work, and they're centering new things in their life. What exactly it is, I'm not sure what. But I do think it's possible that workism is on the decline. But again, this might just be a seesaw. It might be that Gen Z, that, you know, the boomers were workists. Gen Z is pulling back from it a bit because they don't want to be just like their parents. But maybe, you know, the next generation is going to throw itself into work even more.
You've mentioned that we're not as unhappy in our work as a nation as some folks might lead us to believe. And that because there's so many headlines, I mean, and especially in the COVID era, of people like the quiet quitting, people abandoning their jobs and saying, screw this, I hate work, I'm going to go hike for the rest of my life or something like that, and now we see more people re-entering the workforce. But like, why do you think we're not as unhappy as some people might lead us to believe? I saw this stat from Monster the other day. 95% of U.S. workers are planning to apply or at least look for a new job this year. So that's a ton of people in 1 year who are playing. That's the vast majority of people.
Where was that survey?
It was Monster.
Where was that survey?
Monster.
Yeah. Do you think they maybe have an ulterior motive to make people think that people want to switch their job?
That totally could be the case, right? For sure. But it's just interesting that we would say people are actually less unhappy than we might think in work, but that also so many people, there's all these headlines and there's all other stats that people are saying, I'm going to look for something else, or I just want to work less altogether.
I think it's totally fine and predictable that most people would be somewhat ambivalent about their job. Most people would say, I like my job just fine, and I absolutely hope that next year I have either a better job or a similar job with more pay. I mean, that's just human nature. What I find very interesting is that there are a lot of mainstream media outlets in the general business and economic space, your Wall Street Journals and Fortunes and Bloombergs, who run lots of stories every single year pointing out how miserable they think or want us to think the workforce is. Again, you have to go back to the most fundamental bias of news media, which is not a bias toward the left or the right. It's a bias toward bad news. It's a bias toward negativity. Americans are miserable at their jobs is a negative headline that's going to, you know, cue the amygdala to look at it and say, oh, that's a five-alarm fire. People are miserable somewhere in the world. I have to figure out why, and then click on it. A headline that says most Americans are more or less fine in their jobs offers no equivalent five-alarm fire to the mind, and therefore people aren't going to click on it. But if you look at studies like Gallup or Pew or the Conference Board, who ask Americans every single year, how do you feel about your job? How do you feel about your job? How do you feel about your job? Not only are people steadily positive about their work, but at least according to the Conference Board, I think every year for the last decade, more people have said that they're happy at work. I think this is generally a good thing. I think that it's a good thing that people are generally happy at work, even though media headlines are consistently trying to tell us that people are miserable. The last thing I guess I would say about the phenomenon of the media reporting on workplace misery is that it's just way more fun to read about other people hating their job than it is to read about other people liking their job. I don't want to read about other people liking their job. That's just going to make me feel bad. I want to read about how other people are miserable at work so that I can feel the same way I feel when I know that, like, you know, celebrities that are incredibly beautiful hate each other and are breaking up and are cheating on each other. Like, I want to feel like other people are miserable. That's a totally human instinct. And I think that's also why you see news media gravitating toward these negative headlines about people's appreciation of their jobs.
Okay, so what would you say then to folks? I feel like there's been a swing from some folks saying that, like, and we've actually had Simone on the podcast talking about work and the role of work. Stolzoff,
yeah.
Right? On one hand, you've got somebody who sees their work as something that, okay, I'm ambivalent, I'm indifferent, it allows me to pay the bills. On the other hand, you've got the school of thought that says, oh, no, it needs to be this fulfilling thing where you find meaning and satisfaction on multiple levels. It doesn't just provide for you financially, but it checks all these other boxes as well. Do you have an opinion on where an individual should essentially find themselves on that spectrum?
I think we live in an age of impossible expectations, and that's true for so many things. You can start with a category that has nothing to do with work. In fact, in many ways, is the opposite. You know, marriage. There's lots of really interesting research pointing out how our expectations of our romantic partners are really unlike historical expectations of a spouse. You know, today we expect our wife or our husband, you know, maybe our partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, to be sexy, to be our best friend, to be able to be our intellectual equal, to be stimulating in conversation, to be the perfect mother or father, to be the perfect, you know, person to clean up the house, the person you want to fall asleep. Like, we have all of these expectations for a modern partner that I think are somewhat disconnected from historical expectations of a partner, right? So in romance, it is the age of impossible expectations. I think it is also true in work that we expect our jobs and our companies to be much more than just a job or just a company. Not only do we want our jobs more than just a job, you know, the whole concept of workism, which Simone picked up on in this book, is that a lot of people expect that their jobs or their careers do the so-called work of religion, that it should provide meaning and a possibility of transcendence. It should provide a community. It should provide for self-actualization, that, you know, having a job, according to Pew, having a job that you love is now more important to Americans than religion or marriage is. So obviously, we have really high expectations of our jobs. And I would add, in conclusion, that we also have really high expectations of our companies and the organizations that we work for. This is not going to turn into any kind of political point, but you see a lot more employees demanding that their companies make political statements when the news cycle turns toward that political topic, whether it's the war in Gaza or the Don't Say Gay law in Florida or the bathroom law in North Carolina or some other political crisis of the day. There's an expectation that certain companies and organizations comment on that news in a way that I don't think they were pressured on to comment on that news 20, 30 years ago. Now, what does this have to do with, you know, wives and jobs? Well, I think we expect that our companies, in a way, do much more than just be a company. We ask that our companies reflect our values in the public square. So across the board, I think, in romance and in work and in politics, I think we live in an age with impossible expectations. And it just happens to also be true for our careers.
Totally agree. Yeah, like someone's probably thinking, we just want to make tires. Like, you don't necessarily need to make a statement when it comes to Israel and Hamas. Or,
yeah.
But to play devil's advocate, though, I do think, because you recently, like I guess a couple weeks ago at this point, you wrote about just the decline in religion. And, mm-hmm. like, essentially, it's an institution. And to a certain extent, like, I think our workplace can provide a sense of community and a sense of belonging that... I think a lot of folks are missing out on, especially like in earlier you mentioned hybrid work and just as more folks are shifting to working from home full time. I do think that there is a sense of identity that folks are missing out on that in the past they had some sort of shared reality that you talked about, right? How there's no longer going to be that sort of shared reality. But I think it's because of this atomization that's taking place of individuals as they stepped away from different institutions. What are your thoughts there?
You're talking about community,
yeah.
And community is a hard thing to define, but the best way it was ever defined to me is that community is where you keep showing up. And you think, where do Americans keep showing up these days? Is it at church? Well, last year, for the first time in American history, fewer than half of Americans said they go to a house of worship regularly. Okay, so it's not church anymore. Is it the bowling leagues? Well, no. Robert Putnam talked about the demise of bowling leagues and various organizations and associations in the 1990s. Is it a school? Well, interestingly, school absences have doubled since COVID. It seems like a lot of both parents and students feel like school isn't a place where kids necessarily need to show up at the same rate that they previously showed up. You know, what is the last community standing? Well, for a lot of people, the last community standing is the office. And by community, again, I just mean where people keep showing up. So in many ways, I think the office was not necessarily built, or our work, our companies, were not necessarily built to be the last community standing. They just happened to become the last community standing because every other community pretty much has wilted away in the last 30 years. But that's not a defense of the workplace community. That is an acknowledgement that work for many people has just become maybe the last community that exists for them. And I see that maybe as, for some people, wonderful. I've loved the people that I've worked with and have definitely made a community. But for a lot of other people, I think that that's sort of a sad thing to fall into.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. One of the things you're pointing to as well is maybe in some ways, at least in the previous answer, we're talking about how we're putting more of our eggs in the work basket. We're like giving it more credence, more say over our lives and how we feel. And that is maybe the last bastion of the community that so many people have. And they're losing that too as they're working from home more. You've talked about that as the worship of work. And you've talked negatively about that, but you've also admitted that you engage in it. So I'm curious how you reconcile kind of that reality, that duality, and if you've changed your approach to work after all the thought you've given to this subject, plus the fact that you're a dad now, that changes everything, right? I mean, I know I'm completely rethinking how much of my efforts, my time, my mental faculties go to my work versus to my family. What does that look like for you?
So I wrote this essay on the religion of workism several years ago, and I'm proud of it, but I also think I mildly disagree with it for the following reason. I think I came down very, very hard on the idea that workism was mostly making people miserable And now I feel more ambivalently about the possibility that work provides a really important ballast for lots of people. And that in the absence of work, lots of people can really struggle to find something else to fill their life. Now, it doesn't mean that work is the best thing to put at the center of your life. It's rather to acknowledge that in a country where community is generally in decline and association is generally in decline, we need something to keep us together. We need some kind of organizing principle to consistently connect us to people. And if we're going to have fewer book clubs, and we're going to have fewer churches, and we're going to have fewer unions, and we're going to have fewer neighborhood associations, well then, what's going to be that binding principle? And if for some people that thing turns out to be work, and they like their job, and I should point out that, you know, jobs in general are a lot more fun, certainly, than they were like 150 years ago, when, you know, common jobs were like, you know, going out on the sea to kill a sperm whale and then crack open its skull and climb inside and get the pus you need to, you know, light lamps in the street.
At least in theory, that sounds awesome, but I don't want to really actually do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. No, it does. No, reading about it is awesome, right? So, we can have comfy jobs where you talk on podcasts and then read Moby Dick in an air-conditioned room rather than actually have to go out and get our boat crushed by a huge sperm whale. I think that there's lots of ways in which I think the phenomenon of centering work can, for some people, be really important. I'll say as a personal note, you know, I lost both my parents to cancer in my 20s, and one of the difficult things about grief is that it so utterly discombobulates your life. And one of the things that I found most helpful, I think a lot of things people find most helpful about getting over a major loss in their life is returning to some kind of regular routine. And having work be the anchor of that routine actually in many ways made me happier. It's pretty rare, I think, to hear that having a job helped you get over grief, but there's no question that having a routine helps people get over grief, and work is an important routine that helps to anchor people's lives. So that's a long-winded and somewhat personal way of saying that I think I might have gotten aspects of the workism thesis a little bit too negative, that I do think that a religion that centers work is probably not good for people's souls. But having work be a really important core part of your life can absolutely be part of a balanced and wonderful and rich life, even when, as I do, even when you become a father and just want to spend all your time, you know, snuggling with your adorable chubby 8-month-old.
And sometimes that's fun, and then you want to get back to work too. So
you know what? Yes. Yeah. I mean, right. Like 5 hours of snuggling an 8-month-old who can't talk is like, you know, 30 minutes is really fun.
Yeah.
And then after 45 minutes, or, you know, 3 hours, 3.5 hours, sometimes you're like, okay, I'd like to sort of diversify my day a little bit, you know, refresh the joy of, you know, squeezing this little baby. You go to work and then come
it
right
just
back.
Makes you appreciate it all that much more.
Exactly.
Yeah. 24/7 cuddle sounds like overkill.
Yeah. Recently, Joel and I were talking about this too, just rhythms, like you're saying, and you're talking about with the rhythm of work, but even just the rhythms of movement and coming back from spring break, we were both sharing how, you know, it's good, but it's also really good to be woken up by your alarm at 5:45 and to kind of get on with your day and doing the things not only that you love, but the things that also bring you health. But Derek, we've got just a couple more questions that we want to get to. Specifically, we're going to touch on AI. We'll get to that and more right after this.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's say you've been listening to the podcast and now you're finally ready to start implementing some of the financial morsels that we're dishing up. Maybe you are trying to save up some more money for a down payment on a house, or maybe there's a big vacation that you have been dying to take. Well, the money app Monarch. They make it so easy to help you to reach your financial goals. That's why the Wall Street Journal, they named it the best app for growing your savings.
Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, collaborate with your partner even. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. And you won't get spammed either. Monarch features ad-free privacy you can trust. They will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads.
That's right, man. And after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. It just makes sense. It works. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. That's monarchmoney.com/howtomoney. For your extended 30-day free trial, go to monarchmoney.com/howtomoney for an extended 30-day free trial.
All right, we're back. Still talking with Derek Thompson. We're talking about work. And Derek, thank you for just kind of getting personal with in that response to that last question. That
totally.
I think there's a lot of truth that people feel to that. That sometimes even there's maybe a negative attachment to some parts of work, but there's a positive attachment in other ways. And I think we all feel that. But let's talk about the future of work real quick. Like, everyone is asking the question about AI. How's AI going to change the way we work? This is something that you have dedicated some of your thinking and writing to as well. I guess I'm curious, where do you think things stand right now? It feels like actually things have calmed down for a second, because maybe like a year and a half ago, a lot of freak out about AI and how it's going to impact all of us. People aren't as worried right now. Like, where do things stand on that front?
Before I went on book leave, I wrote a piece that at the time I thought might not hold up very well, but in retrospect, I think has held up pretty well, which the headline of which was AI as a waste of time. And what I meant was not that AI is, the generative AI, ChatGPT and Claude 3 from Anthropic, not that they are a waste of time for everybody, but that one way to understand the majority of use of these generative AI tools for people that maybe don't work in computer programming, where I think it's just become a kind of permanent co-pilot, is that a lot of people are just sort of playing around with this thing. And that's fine. You know, lots of important products. The computer, for example, starts off as a kind of toy and then evolves to become something that is central to our working lives. But the truth is that I don't think, I think it is still too early to say exactly how and where artificial intelligence is going to change the world. And just two specific thoughts that I have about that sort of, that frontier, maybe like the edge of the present. One is, I am really curious about AI and medicine. There are lots of scientists that are using protein folding tools and large language model tools to essentially speed run the search for molecules that can bind with certain proteins and do certain things in our bodies that can make us healthier or fight diseases or cure cancer. And I'm really interested in at least trying to stay at that frontier to understand how we're using these tools to discover new medicines. The second thing that I read recently, and this came from Ethan Mollick, who's a really brilliant AI writer, has a Substack, I believe, called One Useful Thing, and just wrote a book called Co-Intelligence. And he has a section in that book about co-intelligence where he talks about how AI might change the career pathway. He says that, you know, a lot of young people start off learning skills that are very, very basic. And they move from those basic skills, sort of the 101 skills, to the 102 skills, to the 201 skills, the 301 skills. But one way to think about what ChatGPT is good at is that it's good at being like 100 entry-level employees at once, right? It does the work essentially of like 100 entry-level employees. It's not a great CEO, but it's a really great research assistant. Well, what happens to the career path as lots of the work previously assigned to 22 and 23-year-olds turns out to be more efficiently done by having maybe just one 23-year-old or maybe just one 25-year-old working with ChatGPT, right? Maybe rather than hire 10 22-year-olds, you hire one 24-year-old and give them generative AI, and that does the same work. That really changes the entry-level path for a lot of different companies. And so I'm interested both both sector by sector with the changes, but also across sectors, maybe how it changes career development.
It's interesting that you kind of refer to it as a tool. It makes me think of like when personal computers first came out. And so it seems to reason that a good takeaway would be to play with these tools in a way that maybe you are intentionally wasting time because you're playing with it. It's sort of like I did with like a Apple II, whatever, back in the day, like back in the 80s, where you're just playing these alphabet games with a snake and you have to gobble up the letters in order. But it seems like you said that over time, it will have an impact on the career path of folks, not just for individuals who are like medical researchers, but the ability to slowly over time adopt to whatever it is that AI is going to lead different industries towards. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think about it for my own in my own industry, right? I pretend to be an expert about many things, but I'm only really an expert on my own life. And you know, one of my jobs is to explain new ideas to people in ways that they can remember and understand, and then communicate again to other people, right? To get the software of my ideas running on as many pieces of hardware as possible. And generative AI is really brilliant at doing a lot of the work that I think of as quite essential to my job. I'm interested in a lot of different things, work and macroeconomics and the frontier of, you know, cancer research. And these tools are really, really good at explaining novel concepts. So like, if I don't understand what CAR T therapy does, I can just plug that right in to ChatGPT and it can explain to me what this, how to, you know, engineer T cells in order to fight cancers. I'm like, oh my God, wow. Like that's what CAR T's cell therapy is. That's really important to understand. I can do the same thing for, you know, economic concepts. And so I find it very useful to allow me to surf the world as a dilettante with this little thing in my pocket that will explain certain key concepts I don't understand, right? It's a little bit like, you know, if you're traveling in a foreign country and you don't understand the language on a certain sign, you can, you know, hold out your phone and maybe open up like the Google app and just point it at the sign, and then it translates the Danish word for stop into the English word stop. And you're like, oh, okay, great, stop. Imagine that, but for all linguistic mysteries, for all things that you don't understand in the world, right? To have essentially a travel assistant that can translate the world. That's sort of how I use these tools right now. It's a kind of universal translator of important ideas and concepts that I don't understand well.
Okay, last question for you. So when we're talking about something like the ATM, there were all these beliefs that it was just going to get rid of the need for real humans at bank locations. Mm. Or like when you talk about kind of what like kiosks, are we actually going to need physical employees at fast food restaurants anywhere now? And it seems like every time, at every turn, there are all these new jobs that open up when new forms of technology come into being. Do you think that's going to be the case with AI, or do you think it is going to kind of eradicate a bunch of jobs that won't pop up in other places?
One thing that humankind seems to be very good at doing is thinking of new ways to spend money, which means thinking of new ways to employ people.
Yeah.
Because in almost any category in which you spend money, someone accepting that money has money to hire people to grow their business. So, you know, in the late 19th century, the economy was 50-60% farm workers. In the 1960s, the economy was 30-40% manufacturing workers. Today, if you add all the manufacturing workers to all the farmers in America, you get less than 10% of the labor force. So we found a way to take that 90% and turn it into 10%. And now the other 90% of the labor force is doing stuff that we couldn't have even imagined in the 19th century. I mean, how do you explain the concept of computer programming, which now is the most popular major at most of America's elite universities? How do you explain that to someone in like 1860? You're like, okay, imagine a computer. Oh. Okay, well, imagine like an abacus that can like do a lot of other stuff. Like it's very, very hard to do. And we were very, very good at thinking of new ways to spend money. We're pretty good at inventing stuff, although I wish that we were better. And so I could always choose to say history for the next 140 years will be like history for the last 140 years, and we'll just find new ways to re-employ people. It's always possible, however, that AI will do for humans what essentially the automobile did for horses. You know, one way to tell the story of horses in horse history is to say that for thousands of years, we came up with new technology that made horses more powerful with each, you know, every millennium, right? That we invented stirrups, and we invented horseshoes, and we invented saddles, and we invented armor. We invented all these different ways and plows, you know, to make horses more and more and more productive. And then finally, we invented a machine that was just better at horses at everything, and we replaced them with tractors and cars. It's conceivable that AGI, artificial general intelligence, will do for the human mind what the internal combustion engine did for the horse, but that would truly be an unprecedented thing in human history, and it's always very risky to make strong predictions about utterly unprecedented things.
And what you're referring to as well is, you're talking about like moving the goalposts, which we have a love-hate relationship with, because on the personal level, it's a terrible thing because it means we're never satisfied. But collectively, when you're talking about a general population, that is what continues to...
That's progress.
That's progress and innovation and technology. And so that's the part that I love. But, Derek, we really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. Where can folks find all of your different writings and what you're up to these days?
You can find my writing at The Atlantic. You can listen to my podcast, Plain English, with Derek Thompson with the Ringer Podcast Network. And I guess you can follow me on Twitter at DKThomp.
There you go. All right, Derek, thanks again for joining us, man. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right, Matt, what a great conversation with somebody who just an incredible thinker, and we've been reading this stuff for many, many years. And I could have just, I could ask Derek a million questions, but if only he had the time, right?
It's true, yeah. I feel like we talked a lot about media, so hopefully folks stuck around, but what's your big takeaway? Is it more personal finance related? Is it going to be more media, technology, AI?
I think when he said, we live in an age of impossible expectations, I thought that was just, to me, that was, I was like, boom. That struck me like a ton of bricks. Mm-hmm. And I think it's spot on. I think it really goes to a million different things. The expectations we place on what our job should be for us, how it should make us feel, and the sort of way like we expect it to replace religion and marriage at the same time. All of these things that have been foundational to kind of how we go through life in the past. Now work has become, it's taken top billing in our lives, and we expect a lot from it. And guess what?
It wasn't necessarily designed for that. It's shouldering a massive load right now.
Yeah. And it's not that work is bad. Like, I love how he touched on like some of those great things that work can provide too. But that is so true, that we live in an age of impossible expectations. And I think it's the same is true for us on a consumption standpoint. We just think that we need to keep moving up the ladder. And we're very rarely content kind of with the way things currently stand. It's always got to be the next thing. And we all, Matt, you and I included, find ourselves in that camp at different points in time. Like, you know what? This house, is it big enough? Like, do I need to move on up the property ladder? There's all of these ways that we think about our lives. Contentedness is a hard thing for us to feel for very long, I think, as humans. And I think, Derek eloquently discussed that when he mentioned that.
Totally. Yeah, I think maybe related to that somewhat is my big takeaway, which is going to be that he said it's hard to be suboptimal. And this is back when we were talking about media specifically, and how he said that media companies or publishers or individuals have to choose to not be the most antagonistic. And we have seen that. Like, I mean, just look at our political discourse over the past 4 to 8 years specifically.
I thought it was mostly nice and friendly.
I think the same could be true, though, when it comes to what it is that we are pursuing. Because, yes, to be more successful, quote unquote, successful in the eyes of the world is going to lead you down a path that maybe you don't necessarily want to go down, but to live a life that you want to lead, that is more important than being fully optimized, essentially.
And so you might have to give up, to a certain degree, some of the ways you want others to perceive you.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I guess what we're pointing out here is the fact that there's a conscious choice that we have to make in order to live by the ideals that we think are most important to us as individuals.
But, and they're not necessarily the ideals that our society No. And our workism culture
are
proliferating, right? And so, I don't know, I'm thinking about that a lot right now, just reading some books kind of on that very topic. The Second Mountain by David Brooks, highly recommend it. But if you want to live a life that is deep with meaning, work is going to be a part of that puzzle, I think. But you might want to find community and meaning in other parts of your life, too. And in fact, you're going to need to if you want to live that kind of life.
Yeah, and I mean, I was thinking about it somewhat through the lens of work, but just all the other things we do, too. How it is that we consume, how it is we spend our money, how it is that we spend our time. The things that we find interest in aren't only a reflection of like our natural interests, but also the things that we are intentionally placing value upon. But all right, man, let's quickly cover the beer. You and I enjoyed Long Haul. This is a beer by Creature Comforts. This is a Doppelbock. Did you dig it?
Yeah, found a lot of comfort in this beer. In fact, it was delicious. I was going to say it had like brown bread vibes going on for sure. Tasted like a fresh loaf coming out of the oven. And it's something I feel like if I were to do this, which I would, go to an abbey and drink beer with monks, this is the beer that they would serve me.
So on the label here, it literally says something that we have said before when drinking brown ales and Doppelbocks in particular, our daily bread in liquid form.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more. It's the kind of beer that I would expect to drink fireside in an abbey, because there's not like central heat or anything like that, right? So you need to have a raging fire going.
That's right.
But glad you and I got to enjoy this one. We'll make sure to link to some of the different articles that we referenced that we spoke about today with Derek, and we'll link to his profile over at The Atlantic as well as his podcast as well, because it's fantastic.
Yep.
But that's gonna be it for this episode. Until next time, buddy.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.